Okay, today is February 20th, 2014, and this is Karen Brewster and Dave Klein continuing talking about Dave's life. And last time we were talking about your work on your master's degree at University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I had a couple questions. One thing you talked about solo, doing field work solo.
For what?
Doing field work as a solo person. I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about that and what that was like and pros and cons.
Sure. Okay. Are we on schedule?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
It was pretty standard at that time. We didn't have radio contact like we have now with cell phones or even satellite radios. And even emergency locator beacons didn't come into play until much later. And there wasn't very little money to support the graduate programs at the university or to support any kind of wildlife work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did have the advantage in Alaska of aircraft were coming in and playing a major role. So you could get brought out in the field and dumped off, and you, when you did, you made a schedule to be picked up at a certain time, and then you're on your own. So you might be there for 5 days or something like that. You're on your own, and you had to plan accordingly. And there was, I don't know when it came into being, but early we didn't have any radio contact. And later on, we had some kind of a deal that we could contact planes going overhead.
Oh, right.
In emergency. I forget what that was called.
It's an land-to-air emergency something.
Yeah. But never used those things. And of course, you never want to use the other kinds that we have nowadays, and sometimes you don't ever use them. But
those emergency locator beacons?
Yeah, at least you have them and you can rely them and on them, and that gives you a feeling of security. But we never, this was sort of just like, we knew that the old miners and prospectors and trappers, they didn't have these kind of things when they're out there by themselves doing their thing. And this was Alaska, the way of life in Alaska. And so I felt confident because of my own experiences in the field and as a Boy Scout, and I felt confident. I felt self-confidence. And my supervisors learned that I had this capability, so working on my own, and had the confidence to do it, and so we did it. And that was the way most of the field work was done in those days. And so sometimes you were because somebody else was available to go with you. Sometimes that was important because you were, when the summertime was light 24 hours a day and you're making observations on caribou behavior and movement, well, somebody has to get some, the observer has to get some sleep. So you had to take turns sleeping and working together that way. And it's always nice to have someone with you so you can share camp responsibilities and support one another.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're doing, and be satisfying to talk over things when it was necessary. Yep.
Did you ever run into any problems when you were out there?
Never problems that I thought were insurmountable by myself, or the problems might be the plane didn't come on time. And you didn't know why it didn't come on time. It might be because usually meant that the weather wasn't suitable for the plane to come from Fairbanks, if they were in Fairbanks or other parts of the state, to fly into the area where to pick me up. because you had to have reasonable weather, and frequently the pickup spots were rivers or small lakes. You had to have reasonable weather too, and you had the pilot had to think about not only picking you up but getting back,
right,
as well. And so there's always that question. There's a great poem. I think I can think of the author. Maybe he was a biologist, one of the earliest biologists in Alaska. He was an educated guy. He had a equivalent to about a master's degree level, which was unusual at that time. And he had aspirations to be a writer. He lived in Juneau for a while, where that was the headquarters. And I'm still not pulling up his name. But at any rate, he wrote this poem about waiting for the plane, which is really a clever one, where, you know, you try to, and of course it's written from the perspective of, say, a prospector that had been dropped off for the summer, and then the pilot was going to come and pick him up. And it was like, you know, the pilot was the only one that knew. So you had to assume the pilot hadn't crashed and was going to come. And then you're sitting on the sandbar waiting for the plane. And, you know, the mosquitoes are buzzing around. Why doesn't Slim come? You know, he probably got drunk in his native village and is drunk, or he'd forgotten completely about this. And he goes on rambling about it in the prose.
Right.
And then finally, oh, is that him? No, it's just a mosquito buzzing. And and then another one, no, it's a tea kettle. It's sort of taken off the stove. That's not the plane. And finally, the plane comes. That was good old Slim. I knew he would come. it's an excellent one. It's almost the name of the author. But at any rate, I've got a copy of that.
So you planned for extra days just in case?
You were always planning to go as light as possible because you had to end up usually packing stuff. So, yeah, you had basics, which provide a lot of calories, but not necessarily nutritionally designed like rice. Not modern rice, quick cooking, but regular rice that had more calories per unit weight. And we had... You had a few other things that you tried to make them last, like you might have some raisins, and you might have some dried meat, or like salmon sticks were great, mm-hmm. if you could get them, and cheese if you had some, or sausage, things that were packed with calories and some nutrition in terms of protein, fat, and carbohydrates. And then you might have planned to have some survival gear to live off the land. That meant a fishing tackle of some kind, fishing line, depending on where you were. And you carried a gun for bear protection, which you could shoot ground squirrels or marmots or porcupine, all of which I did on occasion if I was running short of food. And you couldn't shoot game species that were, season wasn't open, and we didn't consider that option in the summertime, particularly when you're out there. Yeah, these other things. So you might get a chance to kill a grouse, for example, or a hare. And sometimes I did that when the plane was late. But when the plane is late, you couldn't leave the general area where the plane was going to come because you didn't know when they were going to come. So you fished the local area and maybe get one or two grayling in a little tiny stream, and you realize there were only one or two in the stream, and if you got one, you could still try for the other one, but it would be coming very wise. And you might luck out getting a snowshoe hare. And they had a little bit of rice left, and so you could make a reasonable meal. Sometimes you were staying in there was a cabin available, mm-hmm. And it was a cache. But usually the cache was often locked. But even if it wasn't locked, you didn't want to take any food out of the cache, because there might be a little bit of food left over in the cabin. It was usually rice or oatmeal or something like that. And there was usually a note even saying that help yourself to anything that was left over there. But mostly they didn't leave food in the cabin because the bears, it might be attraction to bears to get in there. So usually cabins that were available to you were not available for food, not a source of food.
Whose cabins were these?
These were old trappers and prospectors mainly. Mm-hmm. Yep. And sometimes we had permission from them to use the cabin when we were there in the summertime, hiking into them and what. And they would tell us what was there and would want us, would say, feel free to use anything, but replace it.
Right.
Which was a standard procedure.
So you didn't have any close calls or scary moments or big adventure stories in your field work?
Well,
you make it sound also ho-hum.
No, it wasn't ho-hum. It was like, for me, at that age, it was just a challenge that made me want to be in Alaska. That was part of being in Alaska, the challenge of living in the environment relatively dependent upon yourself and not on other people, and being able to look after yourself. And if that meant, spending a little time on a stream trying to catch a grayling or two, that was all part of it. And eating a ground squirrel once or twice because didn't have enough food to go along, or the plane was late. But often the plane was late when the blueberries were ripe. And so, yeah, you could spend your time feeding on blueberries. So the bears did it. No reason why we couldn't.
Well, but you were climbing around these mountains looking at sheep and goats. That sounds kind of risky behavior.
Well, fortunately, when I got started on that mountain work on the Kenai, I went out with the refuge manager, Dave Spencer, who had a lot of mountain experience and grown up in the Rockies, I think he was, and he was a good mountain skier. And so, yeah, I learned how to use crampons and ice axes to a certain extent, although you generally didn't learn too much. You just thought you were secure if you had them. And I remember walking across an avalanche chute, which was loaded with snow, and everything else was melted on either side. And I didn't have crampons with me then. I did have the ice axe, and I slipped and went sliding down, and then I had to learn how to use the ice axe to slow myself. Well, I did that because I thought about it, and I stopped before I got to a rocky area, and it's pretty exciting because you try it the wrong way with the sharp point down the snow. It goes in there fine, but it's not a break. You have to put the broad side down and then put your weight on it. And then you came to a stop, or at least I did. And then that was quite a learning experience. I should have practiced that before I went out into the mountains. And that's generally the way we were, though, in those days. And I didn't want to challenge myself too much on rock climbing and that. I was interested in the biology of these creatures, and I hoped I could get by without learning all these extra skills. And for the most part, I did. But I tried to minimize risks up to a point. Sometimes I get challenged to go to the top of a mountain just because I was close to the top of a mountain. And then suddenly I realize, ooh, I was pushing myself beyond my capabilities, and I might have gone up anyway and then got to the top and a nice view and came down. But I never was interested in mountain climbing per se, because I lost interest as soon as there was no beyond the life zone, beyond the vegetation, the plants and animals. Then I lost interest in climbing mountains. Even though my school buddies were climbing Denali and that was a challenge, but I didn't want to go that way.
So can you think about your field work? Well, this is maybe beyond grad school, but when there were successes and when there were failures in your field work?
Most of the failures were related to bad weather. And obviously you're frustrated if you had the clouds came down and you're supposed to be counting mountain sheep and mountain goats and females and young relationship, and you couldn't do it. And if the clouds hung down there, generally I can't remember when I was totally fogged out by that. And maybe a couple of days at a time. And I remember a big storm when I was in the White Mountains that I had a little pup tent and had a floor in it, fortunately, because the tent would have blown away. It was a super storm in middle of July or something. And it I was probably in an exposed area. And it went on for hours, and I was just, you're inside. And it wasn't raining too hard. It was raining a little bit. And so I was relatively dry because I had the tent over me, but the tent would have blown away and it blew down. And all thing you do there is just lay down, spread yourself out to keep the tent from flapping too much. And then finally the storm subsided and it out, and it had rained a lot, and it was a nice world again.
So what did your parents think when you decided you were coming up to Alaska, going to graduate school up here? I know you'd been here before, but that was a short term.
My father died when I was in the Navy after high school, and that was about in 1940. Six, I think, he died. My mother was, let's say, concerned, as a mother should be, that I was going so far away into a country where, yeah, there would be adventures and risks. But she understood that as a young man, that I was attracted to this kind of adventure. And she understood me well enough, because I had, when growing up, I did adventurous things too. And both my father and mother were concerned for my well-being, but they also wanted me to think broadly about how I might fit into the world, and they were aware quite early on that I was oriented toward the outdoors and toward nature and toward the natural environment and toward agriculture and farming, to renewable resource living, and rather than any kind of industrial or activities. Although my father was a machinist and worked that way, but he was also definitely involved in, loved nature and was an environmental conservationist himself.
Did your mom ever come up and visit you up here?
Yes, she did. Yes, she was up, I think, twice. Once when I lived in Juneau, and I was working there for the... That was when I just, right after statehood, and I was working for the Department of Fish and Game. I'd transferred there, and I'd been working in Petersburg before under the federal government during territorial days. And so she came and spent the summer, and we spent a few weeks, a couple of weeks with us, and then my family was young then, two children, and we got out on the water quite a bit fishing. My mom loved to fish, and so we got out fishing a few times, and it was a nice visit. And then she came once after I had them to, we'd moved to Fairbanks, and I was a wildlife unit leader on the faculty and lived on Miller Hill. And she stayed with us again for a couple of weeks, and we toured her around a little bit, the regional area, and out to Chena Hot Springs and areas where I think we even went fishing once with her too. She's interested in, loved fishing.
It's interesting. She liked fishing.
She loved plants too. She was, she always wanted a greenhouse, and we didn't quite have that. But we had lots of gardens, and she was obviously very active in gardening and indoor plants, house plants as well. And she definitely influenced me about wildflowers and nature and botanical aspect of nature.
So all our talk about your work on your master's and coming to UAF for grad school has all been the schoolwork and the field work. And what about fun? You must have done things for fun.
What about what?
Fun?
Funds?
Fun. Did you do things for fun, recreation? You didn't just study and do field work all the time.
The amazing thing about my whole life is that I've enjoyed field work. It's about as much fun as you can get as an individual. When it came to sharing it with family, yeah, camping and was still the major things that I imported, that were important to my life, and with students as well. And I did a lot of field trips, organized a lot of field trips for students. Some of them were not related to any specific course or training, but they were related to my responsibility, I felt, in helping them to how to learn to live in the wild, because some of their thesis research was in the wild. Mm-hmm. And that included both in the summer as well as in the winter. So winter in the Arctic as well. And for my family, it was somewhat similar. We had, we did field ski trips in the wintertime, some of us, and frequently the whole when we could get the family together, because the kids, by the time they were preteens and teens, they were busy with school activities. But yeah, generally we could do that. And then we decided to build, get a lot out at Quartz Lake, build a log cabin, which was a family project. And we spent time out there swimming and building the cabin and enjoying the environment. And it was often, sometimes not as much my son there, because he was in Boy Scouts and staying in campouts around Birch Lake. Mm-hmm. But he was played a major role in helping to drag the logs for the cabin and carry the wood up for the cabin. And And yeah, and they was out there a lot of times with just the whole family. Swimming was important for all of them, as and all of us and the family, and in the lake. And we didn't do much fishing, but we did a lot of swimming and some hiking. And in the wintertime, winter activities grew into skiing later.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about when you were in graduate school, what you and your fellow students did for entertainment in Fairbanks.
We didn't have a lot of free time because we're in the summertime, we're working for usually the federal government at that time, yeah, on wildlife-related studies. So I worked on these mound sheep counts, but also I worked with some caribou composition counts and in the Nalchina area. And there was, when we came back on campus in between these field deals, yeah, what do we do? We didn't have too much time before we were out on another one. In those periods, we sort of socialized around campus. We never had a lot of money to go out, and there was no place to go out and spend it close by. To go downtown was the closest place you could go to get a beer, and you'd have to, unless we had vehicles available, which we didn't generally, you would have to walk into town. And there were one or two bars which we thought were reasonable for us to go to, because we were concerned about some of these bars were not safe places for students to go that didn't have anything to be ripped off from. And we didn't want to get into brawls, and we didn't want to get drunk. We couldn't afford it. But we did like an occasional beer. I remember making one or two excursions to Esther, where you could get this beer that, I forget what it was called, Brewster or something. No, it wasn't Brewster. Bulldog, I think, that had slightly higher alcohol content. And we could only afford to buy one beer each. But we got up there, we might have got a ride. And we'd do occasional things like that. But we also, there were things on campus too, like they were being invited to the dinners by the wives of our faculty members that were really good about that for us grad students. And then if one of the students was going out to do a project, there might be a chance for us to go along and help out, because then they had a vehicle to university vehicle or wildlife unit vehicle, and we'd go out with them. So it was Ed Was, who was working on a grayling project out at Salcha, and that was quite a trip on the gravel road then. You didn't just whip up there and whip back again like you do now on a good paved road. Or sometimes it was somebody working out on the Taylor Highway, and we'd make it into a several-day trip. And it might coincide with hunting season, so we could maybe, if we're lucky, get a caribou or a moose. But we always harvested other things. Like, we were all pretty ardent hunters, and we'd harvest spruce grouse, and rough grouse, and ptarmigan, and fish if they're available. But Nene was in exploring and seeing new country. I mean, that was part of being in Alaska. Fairbanks isn't representative of the state of Alaska. And so if we had a chance to get out on the Taylor Highway, or we worked as the federal government wildlife management program on the state under territorial days. They operated checking stations on the Cease Highway. And so they would employ us at a very low wage, but it was good training for us and to go out and work at these checking stations. You know, so there was kind of made by a building there, trailer there, and we'd pitch a tent for sleeping, or maybe you could sleep in the trailer if it was suitable, adequate. And you'd interact with hunters, and it's a good experience for us. But we'd have some free time, and the free time was hiking and hunting or getting to see the country and enjoying it. That was mostly in the fall during caribou hunting season.
So tell me more about these checking stations. What were you checking? You were checking for permits or?
The checking stations were where all the hunters technically were required to stop. So there are a lot of signs along the highway saying stop at the checking station. And then they would get instructions on both where they could hunt legally and what the regulations were, refreshing them in their memory and enlightening them. But then to check them as they went in, and then to check them when they come out. So you wanted the same hunters to stop when they came out, because you had this information of who went in, and even if they didn't get anything, we wanted them to stop and tell us, because the wildlife management agency then, this territorial days, was they wanted to know hunter success, and so how many hunters were in an area, and what the success was, and what the sex and age ratio of the harvest, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we were often collecting things like lower jaws for aging the animals, and also sometimes stomach samples, or mainly that, I guess. And from the hunters, and of course that was voluntary on their part, but they were informed of why we were going to do it. So as part of it was education of the hunters as well about the kind of studies that we're involved in. And it was, while it was education for us, it was more important that to educate the hunters as to why we wanted to know the age of the animals harvested, why we want to know what the sex ratios harvested, et cetera, and what the success ratio of the hunters were. And so that was a good experience, but it was usually in combination with the military, who would assign someone to work at the check station too. They're so-called military game wardens. And they often had military equipment, like track vehicles, like weasels. And so they could go out and check the more remote hunters, and especially if they were military people, be sure they had proper licenses, et cetera, which were subsidized, those licenses for military. It was only about 25 cents, but we wanted to keep track of what they were doing. And so we got to join up with them, frequently get out in the backcountry with them, with their track, a weasel, for example. And so you get to know the country better and enjoy it and appreciate it. And so it was like all of this was just nirvana. I never expected Alaska would be such a wonderful place for me with my interests to be present. And so that, like recreation activities on campus, maybe, yeah. Played ping pong, and they could socialize a little bit with females that way. But eating in the cafeteria, but it was not the kind of a campus you would view within the terms of the present perspective. And plus the fact we were grad students and had served in the military and were a bit older, our focus was on getting the degree and learning process. And so we were good students in that regard, but we also had good contacts with some few upper division students in biology and wildlife, and also anthropology, quite a few, especially females. So some of the females that I hung out with were in the cafeteria when you're eating your meals, where George Soller's future wife, Kay Morgan, she was in anthropology. And there was I'm trying to think, the wife of Governor Hammond. Bella Hammond. She wasn't Bella, I forgot her last name then. She wasn't married yet, but she was already engaged to Jay Hammond, who had graduated a year before I got there with a degree in biology. Mm-hmm. And so she was one of them that we ate dinner together with. There were about three or four women that were all seniors, I think. Mm-hmm. And here were these older males, veterans, grad students, were, I'm sure, attractive to them, but we were attracted to, it was mutual.
Yeah.
They were the kind of women we could be attracted to. But we knew that Bella was not available. But she was such a nice person, We enjoyed her presence.
So did you have dances on campus?
There were dances. We weren't big on that kind of socializing. None of us. Yeah, they had the standard kind of dances. Mm-hmm. We didn't get much involved in that. Partly because we came there as graduate students, we came there and not hadn't come through the undergraduate program. There were a few of the undergraduates that were close to two that were we interacted with, and there was a Wildlife Society, our wildlife chapter of the university, which was very popular. We put on a game dinner, and with all kinds of wildlife that we harvested. But key people who attended were Otto Geist and Ivor Scarlin. Mm. We had a good relationship with them. And we were taking some of Otto's courses, like Alaska Natives, but they sort of befriended us grad students, and so we often hung out in evenings. I wouldn't say hung out. We made a stop at the coffee shop that would usually be part of the cafeteria or something open in the evening for coffee, and you paid extra for that and for the cup of coffee. And Otto and Ivor, both bachelors, would usually show up, and we'd join table with them. And that was fascinating. They would tell us all these interesting stories. And they also hosted us, I remember, one dinner at the old Scarlin cabin where Scarlin was living. Mm-hmm. And he and Otto put the dinner together, and they invited us wildlife grad students. And that was very entertaining. They were such good storytellers about their experience working together in the field. And Otto with a great sense of humor. By the way, I'm having an interview next week with Marika Guthrie. Mm-hmm. She wanted to interview me about Otto Geist and how much I know about it.
Nice, that's good. That's a good idea.
Yeah, I think so.
On the hunting check stations, did the hunters cooperate?
Yeah, for the most part they did. And they sort of thought, it was presented to them as important and a requirement. It wasn't They didn't have to stop if they didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
And it was advertised in the local papers as such. And but it was interesting because I remember when I wasn't on duty at the time, but one of my school buddies was, and he's out talking to this hunter, and he has a sort of like a station wagon, an old Jeep station wagon or something, and they had been hunting, and they're coming back, and suddenly, kabang, this shotgun inside went off and shot a hole through the side of this station wagon, just missing this student and the hunter. And it went off because a dog, a good retriever in there, was getting excited, and they had stepped on the trigger of the shotgun, which shouldn't have been loaded, but was. So there was this risk of all of the careless hunters and careless use of firearms. And so there were potential accidents. And then we often took weights if they wanted to allow us to take a weight on they had a whole caribou.
Mm-hmm.
We had a big tripod and we could take the weights. And some hunters were very cooperative and, you know, they wanted to contribute something to help understand the situation. But when we told them about collecting stomach samples, rumen samples, and how to do it, and we provided them with the plastic bags and everything, they usually, when they brought the samples out, they said, "You didn't tell us how bad smelling this stuff was, and you get it on your fingers." They already knew that if they got a gut shot on a caribou, you hit the rumen and it can damage a lot of meat.
Right.
So
I'm surprised that they even had them. I mean, don't you gut it out in the field and leave that out there?
Yeah, well, they would normally leave it out there, but we wanted them to take, provided them with Ziploc whirl packs, and they could put sample, not very much, you know, like.
Well, this is when you stopped them on their way out.
Yeah, they came out, we gave these to them on the way in.
Right, right.
And we didn't say they had to do it. They said, "Would you collect a sample for us?" And they said, "Yeah, they'd try to." And so when they came out, they'd bring it back out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they were mostly cooperative and helpful in this. There were some that were, they were probably potential violators of the law and didn't want to risk exposing themselves. But we didn't we counted the numbers they had, the animals, of course. And so the check stations were important in preventing violations of the law as well. So it was check stations, my view, were good because even though they were costly in terms of human hours to operate them and the problems with not everybody was cooperative, but they were informative to the public. And that's, to me, been a shortcoming in wildlife management, is informing the public as to what is involved in wildlife management, good wildlife management. And that's where I've had problems with Fish and Game in the past, and still do, that there's not enough information going out as to what's being done to learn about wildlife habitat relationships and relation to management. And we need to be more effective informing hunters about all this.
Mm-hmm.
So that trying to get hunters to cooperate in management and seeing rather than just seeing us as game wardens. So that was part of it too. I mean, we didn't have enforcement authority as students working out there. If someone had a violation and if there happened to be a game warden with us, well, they were the ones. But all we could do is say, take all the information and pass it on. So that they could be checked again by the game warden. But we didn't have any enforcement authority, law enforcement authority. Mm-hmm.
And so where was the check station that you worked at, or you worked at different ones?
There were several. I did one on the Cease Highway, and that was like about just when you're getting up into the Alpine Zone, so about 76 mile or something like that. And then on the Taylor Highway, I operated check stations here. That was close to Mount Fairplay. Once you get out ways up into the, where you're liable to get into Caribou, then operate. And these were, you know, these like house trailers that belonged to the state or the territory. And we, you know, camp in those mostly.
Mm-hmm. So any place else besides the Steese and the Taylor?
Oh, they were on for hunting in the Nalchina area. There were check stations, but I didn't work on any of those.
You just worked at the Steese.
It was mostly any of the road access major hunting areas. Then that was the case. It was the Steese and the Taylor Highway here that where check stations were important. And in south of the Alaska Range, there were probably on the Denali Highway, there were check stations, mm-hmm. and also on the, well, the Parks Highway in those days didn't exist.
Right, and I was thinking the Hall Road, and that didn't exist either.
No.
So this was all before statehood. This is when it was territorial?
Yeah.
And so why did they discontinue using them?
Well, then, a lot of reasons. One is by statehood, you know, there were more road systems, and then there was the cost, too, of setting up check stations. Costs money. And they didn't have a very big budget. And so do you put more money into check stations, or do you try to live without them and do more studies on the animals in the wild? And, you know, what is the cost-benefit ratio for the state and or the territory in operating check stations? How important were they for management? And it was complicated, too, because I know check stations on the on the Richardson Highway, some of those were designed for sheep hunters, primarily, but also caribou, sheep and caribou mainly, but also moose, but mainly it was sheep and caribou.
And the ones that Mestice and the Taylor where you were, that was for caribou?
Mainly, but it included moose and also mountain sheep if you hiked off the Steese a long ways. It could be moose, like over into Gnome Creek, in the hills and the mountains in those areas, Cache Mountain in those areas, or, yeah. So, but it was mainly for the caribou. But we recorded information on how many grouse or ptarmigan they killed, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Anything that they had harvested.
Well, yeah, I mean, as Alaska has grown, there's more roads and people flying. And
in that era, though, of the the territorial days and early statehood, there was much more emphasis on management based upon harvest statistics. So you wanted good harvest statistics. And they gave you an indication of trends in populations. And they were frequently the harvest statistics required only one or two technical people in the office in Anchorage putting this stuff together and summarizing it. And there used to be very good harvest statistics available and those are still available and for comparison with the present time. So that was all very important.
Mm-hmm. And then it shifted to doing more the actual field biology studies of the animals. instead of relying on the harvest statistics?
Well, at that period, and at that period, in terms of the management of wildlife under federal government, the focus was heavy on one. They didn't have a lot of biologists. They had a lot more game wardens, and there were predator control agents killing wolves with poison and cyanide guns. Mm-hmm. And but these people were all important because they collected information on wildlife, incidental to what they were doing. Sometimes it was biased by their what they were doing and their interests. But the biologists were sort of newcomers, so we're finally getting some science into the whole operation. Mm-hmm. And the biologists initially were the rest of the staff were skeptical, the game men and what, about the need for biological studies. But gradually it became apparent that we needed those studies. But the biologists initially were assigned to a specific species. So there was someone assigned to moose, who was based in Anchorage, but it was statewide for moose. Someone for caribou was primarily in Fairbanks supervising. There might have been people working for them, but they were the supervisors. Their job was moose versus caribou, mm-hmm. mountain sheep, and then in southeast Alaska, deer. And that was about it. Then they also had responsibilities for other wildlife, but there weren't biologists hired specially at that time to look after, say, fur bears, or certainly not non-game species, but for fur bears, and nobody working specifically on usually bears or other carnivores like wolves and fur bears, coyotes. Predator and rodent control had some concern about these because they were poisoning wolves and coyotes and were not supposed to be killing bears in the process. So there was some focus there on that, but it wasn't, the biologists weren't working specifically on this. Mm-hmm. And there was one law enforcement agent who was an outstanding guy based in Fairbanks, Ray Wolford, who, longtime game warden, but he was very understanding and knowledgeable about wildlife use. And he was really started collecting of subsistence hunting data. Mm-hmm. So how important was harvest by native people? Native people were primarily ignored. And the attitude was, we exist for these sport hunters, and they're the ones that are paying for our positions frequently as biologists, because they were paying, sport hunters are paying this excise tax on sporting arms and ammunition, and that was made available to the territory and the state on the basis of population, hunting licenses sold, etc. Whereas the other people, like the game wardens and predator control agents, were supported through the federal budget exclusively. And they responded to requests for reducing wolves out on the Seward Peninsula because of the reindeer herding, mm-hmm. and coyotes who had gotten out there. And then out on the Aleutian Islands, where there were sheep ranchers and the foxes were killing newborn sheep, domestic sheep. And so they'd go out and poison and shoot foxes. In southeast Alaska, they were killing wolves to help the deer population when there was an overpopulation of deer and not enough human hunters to control the deer population. So they were killing wolves and using poison baits, and they had to be very careful because they could only do this in the winter when bears were in hibernation, and they were supposed to go out and pick up all of the strychnine baits and seal blubber. They were killing seals to use as bait, which seals were not protected at that time. In fact, shortly after statehood, they put a bounty on seals because they were competing with salmon fishermen.
Okay. So now let's get us back to more chronological, where we were going with. So you completed your master's degree in what year?
That was in 1953. And then I had the last couple of years as an undergraduate, or year as an undergraduate, and the 2 years as I was a master's, I had a deferment because I was suddenly with a new draft law under, I think it was the Nixon administration, when we're at war, so-called war in Korea. And so that new draft law required 2 years of military service, whereas when I'd enlisted in the Navy right out of high school during the Second World War, I had enlisted, and then 6 months after I was in, the war was over. And so I got out of the, had to stay in a full year.
Yeah.
Because I enlisted for the duration of the war plus a year. And so I thought I was draft free. But then when the Korean War came along and I was as undergraduate student at the University of Connecticut, I realized I had to get a deferment, educational deferment, if I wanted to finish up my degree, and I did, and then I got another extension to do the master's degree at the University of Alaska. But then, after...
So you'd served a year, but then they changed the rules and said you had to have a minimum of 2 years?
So that's the new draft law during the Korean War said exactly that, yeah. And so they didn't acknowledge...
So even if you'd already served, you...
Well, I served it under a different law and a different... and they passed a new law.
Yeah, it seemed that's
well, I understand how that came about. What bugged me at the time was I thought I had to serve for 5 years in the inactive, it was just a paper agreement. When I was discharged from the Navy, I had to serve for 5 years in the inactive reserve. Mm-hmm. So I could be called up during that 5 year period. But it was more than the 5 year period before we got involved in Korea. And by that time, I was no longer covered by that, and so I couldn't be called up by the Navy, and they passed a new draft law requiring 2 years, and I'd only had 1 year of active duty
in
the Navy.
And you were, at what age were you at this point?
So I was,
Because I would think that that new law in the 2 years would apply to new 18-year-old men who were required to sign up, that if you'd already been in the military, you should have been free and clear.
So I would have been 26 or 7, something like that. But I wasn't married, and I was a student.
Okay.
Under the GI Bill as well.
But anyway, so They called, you had to go do your military service?
I had to get a deferment until I finished my master's. I might have been able to get a deferment to go on to a PhD, but I didn't want to do that. I didn't think I would gain anything by doing that in terms of education. And I figured, well, I just have to face up to the facts. But I did, by this time I was essentially a conscientious objector. And I looked into that possibility because I didn't feel that we should be in Korea in that war, which was totally different than my attitude when I went into the Navy in the Second World War. And so I did learn that, and when I inquired about being a conscientious objector, they said my religious background didn't support it, which I agreed. And so, no, you couldn't do that. So I then learned that if I was, my draft board had been transferred to Alaska when I came to the University of Alaska. And so that if I was drafted in Alaska, I learned that you would very likely not leave Alaska, unless you went to some school or something for special training. So in other words, if you drafted in Alaska, you couldn't go to one of these schools to learn Russian, that was attractive to me, because if you did that, they could do anything they wanted to you after that. But I didn't believe we should be in Korea, and I was becoming more of a pacifist. And so I finally felt the only alternative was to be drafted in Alaska and tough it out, which I did. And so that was after I completed my master's degree. Okay. And so I was drafted then in early summer into the Army, and I went to basic training at Fort Richardson. And then after the basic training, I was... I think they assigned me then to Fort Wainwright, which was called Ladd Field at the time, in the 4th Infantry. And I don't know whether it was before I moved there or immediately afterwards, I was contacted and wanted to know if I wanted to be a military game warden because of my experience in training. And they said it was a good deal because you get to, the commanding officer then was an ardent sport hunter, and you'd get to go in the field with him and do, you know, you'd get special treatment. I said I didn't want to do that because I realized, already had learned that there were violations that were being incurred by the military officers wanting special treatment for hunting big game. And I didn't want to be involved in that. And so I said no, but then they asked me if I wanted to be in a intelligence and reconnaissance platoon for the 4th Infantry, which they wanted people with outdoor experience and the kind of training we had in graduate school and field experience. And it was a small unit of about 25 people and one lieutenant in charge. And it's like scouts platoon. They go out in front of the forces and try to figure out what the military is doing. It's very risky and not good life expectancy if you're on the front. But if you're going to stay in Alaska, I thought it would be great. And their concern was they wanted people with this kind of training in case the Chinese ultimately got involved in the Korean War and invaded Alaska, because it would be the close place and they would not need people. And they had a dog kennel with two dog teams and canoes and riverboats and jeeps and skis and snowshoes, and it sounded great to me.
Right.
If I had to be in, and I didn't really want to be in, but if I had to be in, And then a lot of the others in the scout platoon were, several of them were from university students, about three natives, who one of them was managed the dog kennel, and I worked with them, and I just liked the situation, and I never regretted agreeing to go with them. And then once I was in there, there was a young lieutenant in charge of us, and he was pretty understanding, sharp guy, and he would, those of us who had some graduate training, I mean, he took advantage of that. I had a portable, old portable typewriter that my father had mm-hmm. had that I brought with me into the military, and I'd type out stuff, and he immediately saw that I could do that, and then he assigned me to write up field excursions that we did, that were training exercises with dog teams.
Wow.
And that was just great. Like, there were two dog teams and four of us, two people to each team, and we'd ski tour to behind the teams when the good going, and when it was no good going, we were out in front with snowshoes breaking trail, and it was nirvana experience. And we did a nice trip from Tanana to Fairbanks, and then I wrote up that trip. It was a learning. We stopped in Old Minto and took notes on what was available there if the military had to be in there in the future, like where was there any power plant, anything, electric generator, were there any place for a gathering place, a community place where the troops could meet with the villagers or even mm-hmm. sleep, and how many cabins and where they were, mapping the villages. So it was good training for me, even though, you know, at the time I thought, I shouldn't be doing this. Someone else should be doing it.
Well, they'd say at least you had some fun going out.
I had fun, and I've been lucky that way. I mean, I get these jobs, and people lay something on your shoulders, and you realize they do it because they think you can handle it. And if you do handle it, then you prove yourself, mm-hmm. and you feel good about it. Yeah.
All right. And so how many years then were you in the Army?
Well, I was in for 2 years, and I that was a little pissed about that, because I checked with, and I even wrote a letter to Senator Bartlett, I think, complaining a bit about this, and feeling that my previous year in the Navy should count. And the response I got was not from him, it was from military saying that, well, this was the new law that you have to, there's no and ifs or buts, 2 years, relates to the Korean War. But after I was in for 10 months, finally this notice appeared on the bulletin board that they were recognizing previous military service. So I had to stay in only 1 year. I didn't know it until after 10 months in there. But it was, it finally they did acknowledge this and appreciated that. I never knew whether it was a result of my writing a letter to Bartlett or whether it was because the Korean War was already starting to scale down.
Mm-hmm. But so you never went over to Korea?
Your never time went was there. In Alaska. And I didn't have any real complaints about that. And the training, you know, I saw it as, when I went in, especially in basic training, that there's a challenge. And here I'm older, quite a bit older than the average draftee. And so immediately they assigned me to be a platoon leader, because I had all these young kids, I thought as young kids, that were just draft age. Mm-hmm. And here I was older, and they called me Doc, even though I didn't have any justification for that. And they respected me, too, maybe because of the way I behaved, but And there were some, they were really extreme. You know, there were some that had real problems. And I felt good about the fact that, and they appointed me patrol leader because I think, or team leader, because I could likely have this effect. And then I saw my interactions with the sergeants that were over me as a challenge. How can I hold my self-respect and deal with these guys? And then I began to, after a while, I began to realize, yeah, there was one that was a tough problem, but another one that was great. I made good friendship. He happened to be Filipino, and he had a lot of war experience, and he became a good friend. And the other guy, you're always on your guard. You know, don't let him think he's in control of you, even though technically he does. And so I was beginning to learn about people and how to live with people and variation and try to understand people. And it wasn't all that bad. And especially we got to do some nice trips and riverboat trips and what. And we had a lot of freedom when we were based here at Ladfield. And we had usually a couple of open-air jeeps, and our lieutenant in charge would say, I want you guys to be physically fit, but I don't want to force you to do all these calisthenics and stuff. I want you to get out and be active. So take the jeep and go up there with your skis and go skiing or ski joring behind the jeep, which we did, which wasn't the safest thing to do, but we did that up on top of Cleary's summit. And he'd give us a pass to get out of the gate for this, he treated us well. He said, when you're on base, don't be seen just sitting around, or they're going to come down on me, and I'm going to have to put you out there picking up cigarette butts and stuff like that. If you got free time, go to the swimming pool and go swimming, or go to the library, but don't be seen just sitting around.
So now I'm confused. Were you in then for 2 years, or you were just in for your 12 months?
I was drafted at the time I thought I would be in for 2 years, right. But then after 10 months, they officially recognized that my previous year in the Navy had some military experience, and I got out at the end of 1 year in the Navy.
Okay.
So I ended up with 1 year in the Navy, 1 year in the Army.
Okay. Okay. That's what I thought. Okay. I was going to ask you about the things you did for entertainment when you were in school here. I forgot to ask you, you mentioned skiing. Were the cross-country trails on campus in existence yet?
They were still in existence, but they weren't maintained. And I remember talking with Ivor Scullin, and he told us about the history of the trails. But frankly, I wasn't a skier then. I was a snowshoer. And the rest of the grad students, the only skiing was downhill skiing on campus at that time. There was no cross-country team, and the Ivor was getting aging and was no longer able to go out and use the trail system. But they were there, and there was a little bit of use in the late winter by locals for commuting and stuff, but virtually none. No grooming of the trails, no defined trails, etc. It wasn't until I came back from Southeast Alaska and joined the faculty that I started getting into some cross-country skiing in Southeast Alaska, which isn't the greatest place. And so then when I got here, that's when I got into, and then after I also went to Scandinavia.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we did snowshoeing in the wintertime, and sometimes for recreation, I'd just put on my snowshoes and go skiing down into the flats, which is now behind, it was that area behind college. It's going toward
like behind Beaver Sports and
yeah, that, back into those wetlands
towards Kramer's Field.
There were wetland areas, and you know, if you went down there in the summertime, you were at least in knee boots. And the wintertime, of course, everything is frozen up, and you could go down there, and then you could read all this wildlife in the trails and stuff. There were mink, marten, and snowshoe hares and everything else there. Hmm. And we could go there trapping or hunting. We didn't do any trapping, but hunting. I did some trapping back in Connecticut, but we didn't do any there. And but also we were encouraged by the people at the museum, like Bryna Kessel particularly, and then who was a new faculty member, to bring in specimens. Just seeing an animal wasn't good enough. You got to shoot it and bring it in, and they'll make a museum specimen. I remember shooting a least weasel there once when I was down there grouse hunting, and they did do a lot of patchwork because I shot it with a shotgun, but I was pretty excited to see this time a little, in the wintertime, a little pure white.
Yeah, with weasel. A little black tip on their tail, or does it goes all white?
The weasel doesn't have it. It's all
white. It
goes
white. All white.
No, the bigger one, the more common one, is about this long and has a white black on the tip of the tail. Short-tailed weasel, I think it's called.
Oh, okay. So, after your year in the Army...
Okay, then I was discharged in the summertime, early summer, beginning of summer.
1953.
Or maybe it was midsummer. That would be, what, 54? I think 53, 54, or 55, or 53.
You graduated, you said, in 53.
So it'd been 54 that I got out,
okay.
A year. And then, of course, I didn't. I was here at Ladd Field or Fort Wainwright, and I had maintained contact with the university, and, you know, because I had still had buddies here on campus, and though if I got a pass, I'd frequently go out there and hang out there. And I built a log cabin down on Gina's Small Tracks at that time, and I had a little help on peeling logs and stuff from my military buddies, and I built there. I got a military surplus canvas, and I built a teepee, and I would get a pass for a weekend, and I'd go down there and work on this cabin on it's one of these small tracks that you could get at that time.
Oh, so you did that while you were in the military, you worked on that cabin.
Something I wanted to do was to build a cabin, log cabin, but and then I realized I had this time, and it'd be a good deal, you know, because it's sort of an investment. You didn't have to live on the track, I don't think. You had to build a suitable cabin, and which is what I did. It wasn't like homestead, although my friend Lynn Hollis, the animal husbandryman, had said, he encouraged me to homestead. There were 60 acres that were available up in that area, just on the base of Cedar Ridge,
mm-hmm.
which I was tempted, but homesteading, you had to make a commitment to clear a certain amount of land
yeah.
and plant it, et cetera, and live in the cabin, and I didn't. I mean, I was committed to my my career of being a wildlife biologist and working for wherever they wanted me to go.
Right.
So, but the small track was doable, and Hollis did. He said you can use the tractor and trailer he had for hauling logs, and you can cut the logs on his land that he had homesteaded,
mm-hmm.
which he was ultimately going to clear it and sell the timber, but he gave me the logs. So I went there and hauled the logs, cut the logs and hauled the logs. And then I got some of my buddies to come and they helped peel the logs because they were cut and dried with the bark on.
Oh, yeah.
So they had to be, used a draw knife. But yeah, well, they did that. That was really helpful. But mostly I did the building myself, and it was a challenge to do it.
So did you know how to build a log cabin?
Basically, yeah. I'd build one up in Wild Lake when I first came.
Oh, that's
right. But I also, I was a learner. A fast learner when it came to building and carpentry and stuff. And in fact, a challenge to use the tools you need to build a cabin, which are a little different, like a broad axe for flattening off the logs. And all this was because this was part of Alaska and Alaskan's history, and I thought, I want to do this. I think I can do it, and I want to do it, and here was a chance to do it, and like once I had the thing, it was an investment. I could either live in it, that was the plan, of course, when I got out of the military, and so when I got out of the military, I immediately got a job, because I didn't have any income except for the military, and I got a job as a wildlife technician working with the government, because it was still a territory, and Fish and Wildlife Service, joining teams that were doing caribou work, and some were students at the university, and later students, and it was mostly caribou that I worked with because it was fall and early winter, and but I finished building the cabin during that time when I was not out in the field, which was most of the time. But I got it finished, and in the meantime I was, I don't know where I was living.
How big of a cabin?
It was a pretty good size. It was about 20 by 24. And, it was about as big as I could build with the kind of logs I had, which were good logs.
And that's back in the time before power tools.
I did, all of my sweet saw, axe, and broad axe, and hand tools, drilling, and then driving the pins down through, all by hand. Yep. That's the way that was done in the old days.
Yep.
The only improvement was I didn't use sphagnum between the logs. I used this rolled insulation. No, I don't think they even had the roll, but you could cut it, the fiberglass insulation.
Oh, right.
And that was interesting because you'd, in the fall, I'd lay that stuff down on these long logs and get ready to roll the other one in position. The goddamn red squirrel would be pulling it away to build nests. You had to be fast on that one.
Really? I wouldn't have thought. I mean, I know they pull it out once it's in there, but I didn't know they'd pull it before you got it
out.
Oh,
it was so much easier to grab it. It came off in big strips then.
That's funny. So did you end up living in that cabin?
No, I never did. I put a barrel stove in there, a cheap barrel stove, so that I could go on finishing. I put the roofing on when it was really cold, and you had to put your hands around the smokestack to warm them up, because you couldn't handle nails and things with unless you could do it with work gloves, but anything bigger than that, it weren't enough. And cotton gloves, and you put them, warm your hands up, and then go and do some. And it was like it was getting 20 below or something. I was finishing off. And then I don't think I built much more inside. But it had the windows and everything in. It was pretty much sealed. And then I got this offer of a position in Petersburg with a permanent position as a biologist, which was, of course, my goal in life. It had been up to that time. And so I think I started right in late January, when it was like colder than hell here. And I was able to, I don't know whether I rented that cabin before I left or shortly after, but the housing problem was not good then, of course, for the university, for faculty and students. And so there was a young couple who he'd just taken a position with Cooperative Extension, and he heard about the cabin and wanted to rent it. And of course, the rental would be very low, because all it had was this barrel stove in there and nothing else. And I said, yeah, you can rent it. And I forget what it was, just a couple $100 or something. And but you feel free to build stuff in there, and counters and stuff, and bring tables in and do whatever you can. And so that worked out for several years. And then they finally moved in some more upscale housing, and I rented it again, and to a cook at the military, civilian cook at the military, who had a big family, and it went downhill from then. And he wasn't good at paying the rent, and finally Susan was, he wanted to buy it, and I said, well, it's probably the best thing. So he bought it, and he moved in some Quonset huts and stuff, because he had an expanding family of about 4 kids. Mm. And then he made this terrible mistake of trying to move things together and attach them to one another. Mm. So instead of moving the Quonsets, he moved the cabin.
Oops.
And nearly destroyed it. Yeah. You know, warped it all out of shape, and he got a bulldozer down there and dragged it over there. And then he still hadn't paid off. But at any rate, I went down and visited him once when I came back here, and he said, that was the worst thing I ever did, was to move that cabin. That was the only building of any value, and now I destroyed it. He was a striving young person and with a big family. And at any rate, he did finally pay off and so then I got some benefit from.
Okay.
At a time when it wasn't very much money that I sold it for, but at least it was a time when we needed the money, when I was building a place up on Miller Hill.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about the job in Petersburg. What did you do there?
Well, I was there was a position with the territorial government for a wildlife biologist who would work mainly with deer management and deer studies. And the fellow that had been there was being transferred to Fairbanks, an upgrade, and he was going to take over management of the Caribou.
Mm-hmm.
And Sig Olson.
Oh, okay.
Young Sig Olson. His father was Sigurd F. Olson, who wrote these outdoor books
mm-hmm.
from Lake of the Woods country. That's where
right.
he grew up. Young Sig Olson was Sigurd T. Olson, and I never met his father, but he was a terrific guy. And I worked with him. He had first been hired and placed in Ketchikan, which wasn't the right place for him. So they moved him up to Petersburg, which was better. He had a young wife and starting a family. He had been in the military. And so when I took the position, he was stayed on for about a month and a half to help me get familiar with the position, etc. But I was still unmarried, and he and his family just, treated me wonderfully and sort of adopted me into the family for mm-hmm. a while. And I got to work with him, which was great because I could see what he had been doing and what the limitations were and what is the best way to go in the future. And he was just a top-notch guy. And so then when he left, I took over and rose to the occasion, I guess, and loved it. And then I was there for, when did I go down there?
Well, you said you started in late January, so I'm thinking of 55. If you were out of the military in summer at 54?
January 55, yeah,
is that right?
That's right, I went down. So in 55, I went down there. And then of course, I was, got into the community and this group of high school teachers, women, quickly adopted me and then paired me off with my future wife, who was a teacher there too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got married and in December of 55. So about a year after, close to a year after I got there. And so then started family there and two of my...
What was your wife's name?
Arlaine, I-R-L-A-Y-N-E. Knox. No, her name then was Brown, Arlaine Brown.
A-R-L-A-Y-N-E. Okay. And so what did you do? You were studying deer, right?
Well, my job was both management, that meant interaction with hunters and stuff and getting harvest data and all that kind of stuff, but also to do environmental studies about deer and habitat. And it was before large-scale logging and clear-cut logging started. And there was still, there was selective logging during earlier days by people who, hand loggers they were called. They were also troll fishermen, trappers, and people that loved to live that kind of lifestyle. Harvesting from the sea, living from the sea a lot, but also taking down a good spruce that's up on a slope where they could fall it so that it would slide right down into the water, mm-hmm. and then they could tow it to the sawmill and sell it for a few thousand bucks because there was a lot of wood,
yeah,
a big log. And of course, you had to do it right so it fell where you wanted it to, and you would be able to trim it then and then set it up on skids so that you could let it slide down and wait for high tide so it would go into the water and then your boat could haul it away. And it wasn't that easy, but But these guys were very experienced, and it was selective logging, so they were only taking one here, one there, and not having any significant impact environmentally on the deer or anything else. But then a larger scale logging was being pushed, and then the pulp mills established Ketchikan and Sitka, and then big Forest Service was pushing all this, get this forest into production and forget about everything else, including the spawning streams and the deer and all the things that the Forest Service was supposed to be involved with. And it was like this old growth timber was just wasteful because this wood is dying, the trees are dying, the old trees are dying. And what we need to do is clear cut and then get it all into second growth, and you get much more productivity of wood from the land that way, even though you're being hammering everything else in the environment, especially the salmon and deer, but also hard on bears because the loggers didn't like bears. And it was a challenging job for me because I frequently was at odds with Forest Service trying to argue that these old growth timber close to the beach was a wintering area under severe winters. And if you cut that down, you're going to have massive starvation of deer in big snow depth years. And plus these other aspects of the bears.
Mm-hmm.
And the bears, especially the grizzly bears on, the brown bears on Admiralty Bear and Alfred Chichikov, you know, the fishermen didn't like them because they ate fish. They thought that they were, because they were competing with them, they didn't like the bears. And some of these hand trollers, you know, had this reputation of trolling along the bears out on the beach. They just shoot it and just keep going along.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Whereas also in the community, a part of the economy of the community was guided hunting for people that wanted to come up from the lower 48 mainly to hunt trophy brown bears, and usually brown bears, sometimes black, but mainly brown bears. And those people had good-sized boats and that they went out with the hunters, and they sometimes in off-season were fishermen and did other things. But they were respected because they had to have a license they had through the territorial government, and they were important economically in the community because they food and everything was bought locally. Right. And they didn't want the bears to be randomly killed. The fishermen, the stupid fishermen, just thought anything that ate salmon should be killed. Eagles, bears, gulls, dolly varden, etc., seal, yeah, the whole works. That was the way the world operated then. And but I remember getting into there had been a problem with one of the first logging operations in Admiralty, which later became a national monument, in southern Windfall Harbor, I think it was. A logging company got a sale with the Forest Service in there, and then immediately they're complaining to the territorial Fish and Wildlife about the bears. The bears are creating major problems. We've got people, dependents, that are living in our camp, and the bears are coming into the camp. Why are they coming into the camp? Well, we don't have any good garbage disposal situation, but we're there to log, because the bears are preventing jobs for these people. You know how it goes. And they were logging right in the estuary of the stream, which was a spawning area for pink salmon. And the bears aggregate there because of the salmon, too. And they wanted those bears out. And I, you know, my job was wildlife. And so I contacted my supervisor in Juneau, who was a good guy, but he had to live with the Forest Service, too. And we were, you know, this is Forest Service land. They call the shots. And and I said, this is unreasonable. It's I want to send this strong memo to the regional forester. And he said, no, he said, basically, he could be worse. You know, we could have a worse guy than him. And I said, and finally he agreed that I could fly up to Juneau, and he'd arrange a meeting for him and me to talk to the regional forester about this bear problem on Windfall Harbor, on Southern Admiralty. And we went in, and he was very polite, and the regional forester, and I could see he was an intelligent guy. And I said, you know, this isn't working, and it, you know, the bears are a valuable resource. Oh, well, he said, they're not all that valuable. The timber is much more valuable, you know, of course. and finally, you know, he agreed that they had a problem with the garbage disposal, and they had to do a better job of the garbage disposal. Otherwise, they were the one responsible for the bears being attracted there. And then in the estuary, he didn't think there was strong enough data because the fisheries people hadn't produced strong enough data at the time. But it was generally understood by fisheries people and the fishermen and others and locals that, yeah, this was damaging spawning habitat for the pink salmon. It was thought that the pink salmon were going up these streams rather to spawn, and they were spawning in the intertidal areas. And that was the logging areas where they dragged the logs back and forth and built their log rafts, and then when high tide would come, they would float the log rafts and they could haul them away. And, you know, finally he was getting a little pissed off and frustrated, and finally he said, now, you got to face up to the reality of this thing. I mean, the future of this is logging. The future of this area is logging. And the bears are just going to have to go. They're not compatible with humans out there. They're not compatible with humans. No matter, we made the case for guided bear hunts and all that. And so we parted, and my supervisor said, go ahead and write your memo, at least get it on the record. So I did. I don't think I have a copy. I might have it, but I got it on the record. And then the Forest Service finally came through and said, well, we'll split the cost with the Fish and Wildlife Service to do an estimate of the numbers of bears on different drainages on Admiralty Island, all on Admiralty. So they split the cost. They provided a boat and aircraft, and we had a fish and wildlife boat and aircraft, and we had, there was a helicopter chartered, and we had teams of, I was responsible for doing this study, and, you know, how are you going to estimate numbers of brown bears in the rainforest? The only thing I could come up with was measuring paw imprints in the sand on these salmon streams, which meant we would go up, get dropped off in pairs, two people. One person had a bear gun, a shotgun, usually with slugs, and the other person had a clipboard and tape measure. And, you know, you had to use the rain gear and stuff. And the helicopter would try to find a place where they could land, drop us off up at the headwaters of these salmon streams. And his team would walk down and measure any bear tracks and record them and where they were found. And then they get down to the bottom. The helicopter would pick you up and move you over to another one. So you could do maybe two or three in a day.
So those are different drainages?
And adjacent drainages, and we'd work around the island that way. And so we had a team of about, must have been eight pairs of us. So we had a pretty good sized team, and then we'd stay overnight on the boats, the big guest boats that we had, Forest Service and ours, and we'd be anchored up together. And that was nice. It was a challenge for me to pull this thing off, and I guess the Forest Service were challenging us, claiming that the bears weren't all that numerous, et cetera, et cetera, and that they just moved between drainages, and we didn't know how much they moved. So anyway, we did this count, and then on the basis of differential size of tracks, we estimated the population on any drainage, and then compared drainage to drainage to drainage. And that was, we published on that, and it was a new technique. I published it in the Journal of Wildlife Management. And we were able to make the case that there were a hell of a lot more bears there than was thought to be the case, and that the salmon streams were critically important, because that's where we're seeing them, through the bears. And they were productive salmon streams, and even though they had long periods of time, that was pretty exciting work. You're walking down a salmon stream, and there's a lot of noise from the water. There's riffles and small bleels that the salmon could leap over. And that's where the bears are liable. And there's all this thick brush. Sometimes you couldn't walk in the stream. It was too deep. We had hip boots. And so you'd walk up on the bank, and then you'd jump down on a sandbar. Ooh, and there's a sow with cubs or something. And so, you know, you'd try to back off or something. But we did all of this, and we didn't have any attacks. We had some false attacks and exciting experiences, but we didn't have any serious problems.
What was one of the exciting ones?
I can think of two. One, when we were, two of us were walking down a stream, and suddenly come this windthrow where there's all these logs across the stream, and just it was like this high.
Is that like,
and climbing in the water
with 8 feet down. 6 feet high?
Pardon?
6 or 8 feet high?
Yeah, at least in the high part. And so we're climbing over these to get down to the, just beyond it. It was, you know, 100 yards thick. And we're up there toward the top, but you just up and down, and then you go down, and then there's a bear coming up in the part just below it, where it was approaching this log jam. And so, and it didn't see us because we were down there with just our heads looking over. This was interesting. You know, what's this bear going to do? And a bear was just walking up the stream. And there were no good place for catching salmon there, I guess. And so I probably had a camera, but I didn't have it readily available in those days. It was in my pack. But then, you know, it's close enough that we think, well, you know, it's going to see us and run away. Then we thought, all it can see is our heads. And so it hadn't seen us. And so I think we waved our arms and shouted, and the bear looked up, and still it could all see just these arms and heads. Obviously couldn't identify us. And then started continued walking up. And we didn't know what it would do when it got the log jam, how it would get over it. But I remember I said to Chuck, we better climb up and sort of expose our whole bodies. By that time, you know, we had our rifle ready. We always had it ready, but we climbed up there, and And then we got up there and we shouted and waved our arms. And the bear looked and turned around and ran like hell downstream. Well, then the other one was sort of a byproduct of this count, in that we were doing, we'd get back at the end of the day, and then I'd go with one of the pilots with a fixed-wing float plane, and we would try to do counts of bears along, this was in the springtime, along the, this was at a different time, before the salmon were running. It was a different operation. We were counting, trying to count them out on the sedge meadows and the estuaries of streams at the heads of bays, which bears would be out there munching down on the new green sedge, along with a few deer and a few geese. They're all out there munching on this because it's high quality food and bears are going for that in the springtime. And that's when there would be guided hunters out there, the guided hunters, because the skins were still good in the spring. And so they would go out. The bears would be out there usually in the evening, maybe the wee hours of the morning. But it was hard to get out there in midnight and wait. So most of the hunters went out and late in the day and then set up their place to wait for the bears to come out. And so they were doing that, and we were tied up alongside of one of these guided hunters. And so we socialized a bit with him and his wealthy Texan, who was an interesting guy. But at any rate, then the pilot of this plane was a Fish and Wildlife Law Enforcement Agency, and he was a good pilot and nice guy. And he was an ardent hunter, but he wanted to, he'd been, become a bow hunter, and he'd killed deer with bow and arrow. He wanted to kill a brown bear with his bow and arrow. And so he asked me if I would back him up with a gun in a bear hunt, a brown bear hunt, while we were there in the evening, if we had time. And I naively said, I never shot a bear and I didn't particularly want to, but I figured, okay, yeah. I mean, he was a good hunter and knew the problems. So.
And you're allowed to do that if you were there counting them. You're allowed to then also go hunting.
Technically, we were only working during when we were flying counting. No. So we weren't allowed to go and fly and locate a place, partly because we were flying these places that the guides. We're going with their hunters, and so we weren't competing with them. So we landed, and there was this one place that was, and we had this small boat that we'd, with a small outboard on the big boat that was available. And he said, we came back, and it wasn't a very good day for hunting. We didn't see much. We didn't know why, but maybe we saw a few bears, and we landed, and so, which is a normal time before it gets dark. You don't want to be up flying there when it gets dark, because we didn't have any navigational lights or anything there available to us. He said, well, if we go over to this little cove, there looked like a place where there might be some bears coming out. Let's give it a try. You want to do that? I said, well, yeah, I'll do it. I'll back you up on this. So we motored over to this place, and it was only, 5 minutes or less. And we got over there, and we got on one side of this peninsula that was, and it was the other side of this very narrow peninsula with trees. And so we pulled up the skiff and walked through. And I had my bear gun, rifle, and walked through, and then very careful, and it was a nice, calm evening, and there weren't any bears. There was this narrow band of sedges, which they would be coming to eat on if they were there. It was not a very impressive compared to the heads of the bays and stuff. So we figured, well, that's the way it goes, you know, it's just a chance. And we stepped down onto the edge, the high tide area, and where there were a couple of drift logs and branches of the hemlock was hanging out over a little bit, and sat down on this log just outside of that. But there was, the sedges were in front of us, and enjoying. It was a beautiful evening. We were just enjoying sitting there and watching. If we'd been sitting in the plane for quite a couple of hours at a time, and set the rifle down against a log, and he set this bow and arrow quiver down on the side of the log too, and we're just enjoying watching the evening's light fail, and I don't know whether there was any. There was probably sun that had gone behind the hills, and it was just beautiful evening, and I figured, well, that was that. And this then, whoops, there's a bear, a brown bear comes out of the woods down the beach ways, just before you get to the all the sedge in front of us. And yeah, the brown bear, whoops, another one following it. And the other one, it's a big one. And we realize the first one is a female and the other one is a male following it. And so here we are sitting pretty much in the open, not behind a blind or anything. We're sitting out there on this log, but we're just sitting there. And so it was obviously, and we knew enough about bears, without any movement, they're not gonna, they're basing on smell. And it's anybody's guess whether they're gonna get a smell or not. Mm-hmm. There wasn't much wind. And so he said, oh, this could be ideal. And so the plan was, he was going to try to shoot this big male with his bow and arrow. And he wanted me to be ready, because he said, if I get an arrow in, they're going to come right down here, just really close, and it will be within range of his arrow. And this is the problem with hunting a bears with arrows. They're too damn close to begin.
Right.
He said, if I put an arrow in that bear, and it's a good shot, then it's not going to kill it instantly, and you may have to shoot it right away if it comes for us. If it runs away, well, we have to wait and see and go after it then. But I began to realize this is more complicated than I thought. So he said, we shouldn't move at all or we'll attract the bear's attention. So as soon as this female, and they were only about 12 feet apart as they were walking down the beach, as soon as the female reaches this one rock, which we could identify just directly out in front of us, and the sedges were there between us and the rock, and as soon as they reach that rock, then we both stand up. He had to stand up to shoot his bow and arrow. He will quiver the arrow and shoot the bear. I should be, as soon as we get up, I should eject, put a shell into the chamber and be ready. So I should concentrate on that. Well, both of us had concentration points. And so we did this. The minute everything looked like it was just going by clockwork, you know, they came right down, the sow arrived at this thing and they hadn't seen us. We jumped up. Oh, man. Then they came to life, and the sow started, there was a little confusion on their part, and the sow And by the time I'm thinking, you know, that arrow is going to fly instantaneously, and I'm ready with my gun, and the arrow didn't fly, and the sow started, finally she started running in the direction they were going to get by us, and then the plan obviously was then they could run into the woods, mm-hmm. get away. And the male, he was interested in that female, and he was in charge here, not us. And so the male was starting to act very concerned and not running away. And by this time, the female has made it into the edge of the woods, and we can hear her. She's just running like hell, and she's making noise, like breaking brush, because she's heading out. And certainly the male can hear that, mm-hmm. too. So the male, and we were not quite between the female and him. We weren't in, it was, see, because he had gone around, and he could do the same thing.
After the sow.
Instead, he makes a false charge. Mm-hmm. And so that, then I see this this alder. And then he's got a path over the, he's getting over closer to the woods, but he's not going after the female. He's concerned about us. And so there's this alder, a young alder plant growing there. And he's just, that's sort of between him and us. And I figured, when do I shoot this sucker? Because still there's no arrow flying, no arrow flying. And I just, now I'm thinking, if he's charging us, I mean, I'm going to have to shoot the sucker, even if he doesn't have an arrow in him, and, which, of course, I didn't want to do. And I was ready. I was all the time, had the rifle on him, and a finger was on the trigger, and he makes this false charge, and I figured, if he comes beyond that alder, then he saw me, like, from here to the kitchen away. Okay. I was much too close.
20 feet?
Something like that. And he comes charging, and when he came, he was deliberately, boom, down, making a lot of noise when he hit the ground. And he reaches there behind that alder, and he's thumping the biggest deal right there. And he hesitated for a minute, and I thought, am I waiting too long? No. Will he follow through in a full charge now? And the last minute he turned, and I think we could still hear that female breaking brush, and he headed off in the woods following her. And then I looked around to my buddy, and he was just standing there. He said, I couldn't, I tried to get this arrow in there, but he said, I just couldn't. I mean, I was so excited, and it wouldn't get it in, and I was so concerned about this bear not behaving, not just standing there waiting for me to shoot it. And he says, I couldn't get it in. And then I thought, it's too close to shoot it with an arrow by that time.
I didn't know that you could be too close.
Yeah, definitely, because you're going to wound it. You're not going to kill it instantly. And so I was waiting for him to see that arrow go, and it didn't come. And of course, I was glad in retrospect that it didn't. And he didn't. He realized the pressure on me that, you know, what should I do? And he didn't know whether I was going to shoot this thing or not. But finally, we just both sat down, went back and sat down on that log. And he was still a smoker, and he had to light a cigarette. He said, holy mackerel, I don't think I want to kill a big grizzly any longer with a bow and arrow. So if I do it, if I kill a brown bear again with a bow and arrow, I'm going to go for a small one. So he never, on that, I told him I didn't want to do it any longer. And he didn't want it really at that stage. I heard later he did kill one once, but he went out with another person, and he waited until he could get a small one and finally killed one with an arrow.
And what was that guy's name? Remember?
I think it was Lyman something or other, but I'll have to look. I could look it up probably.
It's okay.
He was based, I think, in Ketchikan. He was a good guy, and I think I had another experience with him that was, might have been bear related, but we had landed in Mole Harbor. Yeah, it was. Mole Harbor was where the bear man of Southeast Alaska lived.
I don't know who that is.
There's a book written about it. He wrote one book and other people wrote books. He was sort of befriended the bears. It's a place, it's now a major bear watching area by the Forest Service has. It's a short flight from Anchorage, from Juneau, and it's in Admiralty Island and head of Lynn, is it Lynn Canal, I think. And it's a fabulous bear pictures from there. Hmm. And it's, this guy got used to the bears, and the bears got used to him, and he never had any problems with bears. And he lived many, many years there.
Yeah.
But he had retired and left, went to the old people's home or something, and his place was still there. We flew in there once with this guy, and there was another person with me, and I forget who it was, and we did a hike. It was beautiful weather, nice and clear weather. And the tide, it's a big, shallow bay. So with a float plane, you got to be careful about tides and what. So we anchored the, we went in there when the tide was fairly low, half tide maybe, but it was a long way from the beach. And so we had a whole bunch, we put together two or three lines. And so we could anchor the plane so that it would stay there, but then I had a line so you could pull that anchor from the end of this line and went toward shore, but didn't get to shore. You had to be there before the tide got high again to pull it in. So then we took a hike up into the mountains, up to a lake in a cabin. That was a really nice place, and a nice cabin was good fishing for a lake. Rainbow trout, and it's a Forest Service cabin you can rent. And we just hiked up there. And then when we started, we'd accomplish that. And then suddenly this overcast is coming in. And there's a big front moving in. And so pilot said, we better head back because that plane is not in a good place if we get a big wind. Set out there in the middle of this mud flat, and which would be in water eventually. So we hiked back down. It was another 45 minutes or so, and got there. No tide's in, and it's we can't get the rope to pull the plane in to close to the shore, and the water was out there, was tide was already, 4 or 5 feet deep. And, he says, what do we do? And I said, I don't like the idea of waiting. It's going to be hours before we can wait for that tide to go out enough so that we could get pull it in. Our plan was that we'd be up there longer. He says, it's the rate of the weather and the clouds are moving in, and it's a storm front that's moving in a hurry. And so he says, I guess we just have to wait. And I said, why not swim out there? And he said, no. He wasn't into swimming in the ocean, and Southeast last night. I said, but, you know, been a nice sunny day. There's a mud flat. The water will be warm. And finally, they said, no. I said, well, okay, I will. And so I took off my outer clothes and I swam out, and the water was really nice because it had been sunny, and I knew from experience that you can go swimming in these places because the water tide comes in over that warm, muddy bottom, and it warms up the water. So it was a nice swim. I swam out and pulled the anchor and got the rope and pulled it back into shore. We loaded aboard and flew out. And this guy was such a macho guy that there was some satisfaction in doing this. But it was no big deal. I'd never swam for a boat because you had to do that for your boats. Mm-hmm. And mostly I would just sit on the beach, and it was pouring down rain and colder than hell, and the beach wasn't, the water in those cases would be really cold. And that was a last resort. And then I'd use my skill to get a fire going with some driftwood, which is not easy when it's raining, and get a fire going and just wait for the tide to get back so you can finally get it out.
Right, so in this case, you made it back to Petersburg?
Wherever we were based at the time, yeah.
Well, so you impressed the tough pilot, huh?
Pardon?
You impressed that tough pilot.
Yeah. He wasn't a tough pilot. He was just typical macho male like the rest of us at that age and time.
Right. Well, I'm thinking maybe we'll take a break for tonight.
Sure.
If that's okay. And we'll move us past Petersburg the next time.
That's good.
Is that okay?
Yeah.